Hi, and welcome to the CBI Exchange, where we bring intelligent insider conversations about the issues that matter most to UK business. In our first episode, we looked at the state of the UK economy and how that might affect the decisions the Chancellor is going to make in this year's budget. Today, we're going to go a bit deeper and look at what it takes to produce a budget and the type of things that we're asking for that we think would have the most impact for the UK economy. I'm joined by Louise, our Chief Economist, Mo, our Director of Economic Policy, whose team was responsible for our submission, and Jordan, our Director of UK Competitiveness. Let's get started. Louise, I'd probably like to start by just getting a sense of what is going on in Treasury at the moment. We've had loads of speculation. I know lots of different people can submit their ideas, their views to the Chancellor. How do they navigate that? What does it look like?
Yeah, so it's obviously quite a complex set of decisions that they need to make. They will have received thousands of submissions, and they will be from organisations like ourselves. We obviously put in our own submission to them back in September, but actually anybody across the public can put in submissions as well. And it was quite interesting last year when they opened the kind of portal for their submissions, it actually crashed the Treasury server because they received so many. So what the Treasury and what the Chancellor will be doing at the moment in discussion with kind of number 10 as well, is to kind of whittle down that long list of policies into those ones which are going to make the budget. And as part of that process, what they will do is they will have a kind of back and forth with the Office for Budget Responsibility. So the process will start off for the OBR giving the Chancellor her economic forecast, which just shows some of the kind of data-driven decisions that they might have made since the last budget. And we know one of those big ones, and I think that we talked about last time, was around the decision they might make around the productivity across the UK economy. But then what they will also do is the Chancellor will start to talk to the OBR about some of those policies she's considering, some of those decisions she might make. And the Office for Budget Responsibility will tell her what impact they think that will have on the economic forecast, how much that might cost. And so then the Treasury will put those decisions into what's called the kind of scorecard. And that really is the table that tracks all these decisions and says, actually, we might have a bit more to spend. These are the amount of kind of revenue we might still need to raise. And that will be what drives a lot of the decisions that are happening at the moment. The Office for Budget Responsibility obviously need those decisions from the Chancellor a little bit ahead of time. So actually, the 21st of November is the kind of cutoff for those decisions from the Chancellor as well. So it really is crunch time now for her.
So I had no idea there were that many submissions. So Mo, you might want to maybe expand on that a little bit as well. But also, in all that noise, how do you get noticed? How can we be sure that the CBI's submission is actually even read?
Good question. So going back to what Louise just mentioned about getting thousands of submissions, in particular last year being sort of that high tide, we know that, I think from memory, last year they received about 17,000 submissions, which did crash the system. And we received a phone call the day after saying, have you actually made representation? Because they were keeping an eye out for us and they hadn't seen it in the system. So we know that they are looking out for us and they do read it and they share it internally and within other government departments so they can see the asks that we have. And I think if I'm ever not in this role, now that I know the process, I will sort of individually make some of that representation myself just so I can call for whatever I think we should do, which is not too far off what we have made representation for as a CBI. But I think that the other point that I'd make here is that one of the reasons why we get so many rumours now is because the process that Louise outlined, the government basically, anything that they think they might do as part of some of these like major measures that they call it, they have to submit to the Office for Budget Responsibility for them to score it and see how much it costs or what it can raise. And so they are all on the table because they want to know the impact and they want to make the scorecard that Louise has mentioned add up. So that's why you end up getting rumours, because the Treasury has asked the OBR to look into it, but it doesn't compel them to do anything with it. They just want to see what the options are. So we've seen a lot of rumours more recently, and that's because of the process working as it should. But, it's that point around it being considered. The Chancellor talked about being determined not to simply accept the forecast. And what she means by that is that because of this process, the Treasury can also put forward policies that could help boost growth and influence the forecast. So we get the first couple of rounds of forecasts in the lead up to budget. After sort of the third round, the OBR starts to layer on the government policies that they are looking at, and those influence growth, they influence employment, interest rates, and so on. And so if the government, when they talk about their growth mission, put forward a set of growth-boosting measures, they will then be able to influence the forecast. And so that's what the Chancellor's talking about when she says, I'm not going to simply accept it. And she's talked a lot about the growth mission. So putting those together means that we would hope to see a budget that is pro-growth and that would back a lot of the asks that we put forward that we're hopefully going to come on to talk about.
Well, Jordan, I suppose that's, we want an optimistic Chancellor. Yeah. You know, that's what people want to hear, is that they've got a plan and they're going to deliver on it. Do you think our members believe it, or are they a lot more cautious?
Well, I mean, I guess put yourself in a member's shoes, right? You know, 18 months ago, we got a big stonking majority. What does that signal? Stability in institutions, stability in policy, stability in direction. You know, since then, it's been a bit of a waiting game, I think, for lots of businesses. Wait for an investment summit, wait for the next fiscal event, wait for the industrial strategy, wait for the next budget that will be 6 months later. And so I think there's a perennial policy cycle that lots of businesses, I think, just don't like. You know, I think they plan in longer term cycles rather than every 6 months. It's not their job also to know what kind of kite flying in the media is real and isn't real. You know, that's not what business spends their time doing. They want to spend their time investing in their workforce and investing in CapEx and OpEx and all of the things that our members love doing, which is to contribute to growth, not necessarily tracking the Daily Mail and the Telegraph every weekend. And so I think the optimism is fantastic, as long as it comes with a little bit of parameters of this is what the government thinks rather than this is what, you know, the world thinks about what should be in the budget. And I think as we get closer, like Louise and Mo were saying, you know, some of those things will harden, some of them will drop out, and some of them will start rising to the top. And so I think firms just want a sense of, you know, what should I really worry about, really, rather than what do I need to read every day? And so the optimism is fantastic, and you obviously need that from a Chancellor, but the optimism has to be matched, I think, with a little bit of helping firms who don't have the kind of political nuance that I guess the people around this table have.
It certainly feels that this one is a lot more than just a fiscal event, though, doesn't it? Like, there is a whole lot of politics mixed up in this as well. On one side, we've got fiscal rules, and then on the other side is obviously that pressure to grow. And it's a pretty fine line that you can see that they're having to do. And I think our members would rather that politics stayed out of it and we just stayed focused on the economy and what's best for growth at the end of the day.
Yeah. Can I just add something to the point Jordan made about this cycle of fiscal events? I think it's a more recent phenomenon that businesses pay so much attention.
Yeah.
And part of that, and I think you talked about it in the previous episode, is around the fiscal rooms and the fiscal headroom that the government has allowed itself to have. One of the pieces of feedback we've had across sort of the last 5-10 years is around, if we have a slightly bigger fiscal headroom, it reduces some of that policy uncertainty. So businesses aren't as focused on the next fiscal event and then the one after. It's good that the government's gone down to one fiscal event. I think if they allow themselves a bit more fiscal headroom, it should then give reassurance to businesses, to the markets as well, that, you know, we can make it to the next fiscal event without having to tinker in between. And that should give, hopefully, a bit more certainty to businesses to invest in the meantime, rather than saying, okay, well, they're not, you know, we may get blown off course a little bit. Let's wait and see, which is what we want to avoid.
It's very much living hand-to-mouth type scenario, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let's talk about what our members have wanted us to champion for and where we've been really focused. I think we've kept it very clear and quite simple in that we've got, you know, the four main areas we've focused on, which is around fast-track infrastructure. You know, how do we really get these big critical national projects over the line? We want a whole load more planners. Everything comes back to planning. I would say skills are planning, but, you know, we want a whole load of planners in there so we can fast track. There's a lot of talk about maximising workforce potential around the growth and skills levy, removing tax barriers on workplace health. We know our members are really passionate about how can we support more people into work and keep them in work. In 2025, you can't get away from AI and the role that technology will have. So I think we'll talk about the National Technology Adoption Plan,
expanding R&D credits to cover capital investment. And of course, Jordan, your area is all about boosting competitiveness, which the last couple of years have been really tough with very high energy costs. We've done a lot of work on the attractiveness of the London Stock Exchange and our capital markets. So I suppose, how confident do we feel, Louise, that, you know, what we're asking for lines up with what the government is wanting about building these strong foundations?
Yes, I mean, I think the big central message for us in our government, in our submission to government, is really around making growth the lens through which they make all these decisions at budget. And I think on that ambition, that is a shared ambition, and that is something that we've been pushing, you know, governments of all colours over the last few years to really make sure we're focused on the growth of the economy, increasing growth, increasing productivity. And that really is what we need to do to make sure we are increasing living standards across the economy and for all households. So I think that, like, that central aim is the same. I think we can obviously, you know, perhaps have a discussion around taxes, which is our other kind of big message, where maybe, you know, there's an active discussion with government there around, you know, we would obviously like to not see any more increases on business taxes and on business costs. But the other big message for us is around that point on really making sure the UK can build a lot more and really accelerating the pace of that and removing some of the barriers to that. And I think that's where there really is that shared ambition and shared agenda. And a lot of what is in our submission is around going further and faster on that. And so I think that's where we can make sure that we're bringing that intelligence from the business community on where they're still seeing bottlenecks, what is the additional support that they need, and really practical things like just having more planners in local authorities so that we can get a lot of the submissions through the system a lot quicker. So I think the submission that we've got is full of really practical things that can help the government further its agenda in also these shared areas of ambition.
I suppose it's actually about, you know, how can we enable companies to actually be able to spend money? I suppose one of the biggest frustrations I've heard from members over the last couple of years is we've got the budget for this. Yeah. We want to invest, particularly if it might be about decarbonising their buildings, and yet they can't get the planning to do it. So for once, we've actually got some pretty large companies out there with significant budgets, and it's the fact that they want to start, but they can't. Mo, you must have had dozens of ideas across the team because everybody at the CBI loves a budget. Yeah. So everyone's got a view of what should go in it.
Yeah.
How did you whittle down, and what was your logic on where you settled it?
So if you ask businesses, in particular large businesses, but most businesses, what their challenges are, the planning and getting things built is a key issue. Having the right people to do some of that is also an issue. Having the right technology and the right systems in place, making it easy for them to know what they should invest in, is an issue. And then whether it's trade or regulation is also an issue. So when you think about those four areas, they are basically the areas that we focused on as part of our submission. We had a number of member webinars over the summer, which again, when we talk about some number of submissions and representation over the last year, there has been so much more interest sharing views and ideas from businesses. And really what we ask businesses is, what are the challenges that you're facing? And so that was the logic was, over the summer, we thought about what our members want. We also looked to other countries, and I have talked a lot about this internally around some of the challenges that and the lessons we learned from the previous administration in the US around, they set out brilliant long-term strategies, but they... One thing that they sort of missed out on was addressing immediate issues that businesses and individuals faced. And so when it came to actually people thinking, am I better off in the last 4 or 5 years? Often they thought, well, maybe not, because I haven't seen immediate improvements. And so what we tried to do is set out practical, as to Louise's point, practical changes that government can implement now to make life easier, whether that was through getting critical national infrastructure built more quickly, whether it was through reducing the backlog in planning, through tech adoption and having a strategy around that. It was all of those things that we tried to capture within this budget to say, here are some practical things that you can implement within the next 12 to 18 months to provide some more reassurance to business and to enable them to do what they want to do and focus on that. And that we started that process fairly early on after the spending review in June. We started to think about this. And as we went through the summer, and again, even over August, we had so much engagement in a period that's generally quiet because of the holidays. And it coalesced fairly easily, actually, this time around what members really wanted to see. And so when we put it back to them on across these four areas, that there was a lot of agreement. And so made our lives a little bit easier. But it just highlights the scale of the challenge, and what members want to see is like broadly the same across like small or large businesses.
And Jordan, you know, what do you think would be the big win for business if government actually acted on these recommendations?
So, I mean, if you take, I mean, as a package on the whole, if they did them all, that'd be fantastic. Great day for the CBI, right? And I'm sure members would get a great deal more clarity. They'd probably get more funding in lots of areas. There'd be incentives for investment. They'd probably have roadmaps in some areas as to when they might be able to spend or when they might get that release. But I'll give you two very specifics where, you know, I go around the country and people always say flexibility in the skills levy is one of our very specific ones, right? So if you're a medium or small business or over the threshold for paying the levy and you just don't have the flexibility to spend it on the skills that you need every day, you know, getting 100% flexibility in that levy could help you hugely in the years ahead, not just on retraining, but also on hiring. And another example, you take PPP, public-private partnerships. So if you're in the building supply chain, of which there are thousands of businesses up and down the country who's had a really tough few years on cost pressures from the pandemic, on post-Brexit world, on in terms of labour costs in some of those building sectors. You know, if you get a public-private partnerships pipeline that is built out that goes beyond the current pipeline of $5 billion, you could unlock a whole load of private finance for projects that can take us up for the next 10, 15 to 20 years. And so I think it does depend on what sector you're in, but there is something in the submission for almost every business in the country. And if government decides to do some of these, it is genuinely real things that can come from it. Yeah. It's not just words on a page, which I think we feel very strongly about.
And I suppose, well, I'm going to come on in a little bit on the things that we did leave out, because I think that's always quite interesting to look at as well. But before we do that, we touched on it at the beginning about who's got the ear of the Chancellor, I suppose, or what influencer. I'm always interested about the OBR, Louise. Like, how much power, they seem to get more and more power, how much power do they actually have?
So they are obviously really critical and really important within this whole process. I think to talk to one of the points that May made it earlier, the reason why they have got so much power or perceived to have that at the moment and are really the people that will help to make that yes, no decision for the Chancellor of what goes in the budget comes down to the fact that she's kind of left herself so little wiggle room, and that headroom is so small. And to be fair, you know, that was the case at the end of the last administration as well. But it's something that has reduced quite significantly. So the headroom we've got now, or like I say, the kind of wiggle room that she's got is just less than 10 billion. I think the average over the last couple of years before the pandemic was more like 20, 30 billion. So what is happening is all those decisions that she's having to make, they're really balancing the public finances kind of on the top of a pinhead. And therefore, you know, if the OBR says, actually, we think this is going to cost you a bit more, or we think the kind of positive benefit in terms of growth and things is a bit less than the Treasury wants, then that can shift the whole dynamic. And so that's where we've kind of gifted them, in a way, a lot more of that kind of power. And I think they themselves would probably like to have less of that spotlight on them, and would like to do the forecasts in the same way that they do now, but without such a kind of impact on some of those decisions that they made in the economy. Because I think everybody, or at least, you know, within the economics community, we all know that even if you make the best forecasts, they're always forecasts. You know, there's always going to be some upside, some downside to them. So I think there is quite a lot of danger when we're saying, oh, in 5 years' time, this is going to be the exact number of something. Like, nobody quite knows. And so I think, you know, the important thing, as difficult as it is for the Chancellor to think about how she's probably going to fill this kind of fiscal black hole, as people call it, actually what she probably needs to do is think about increasing that even more, increasing that headroom. You know, if she can give herself an extra kind of 10 billion, then we get out of this cycle of dancing around these really small movements, which would provide businesses with a lot more stability, and we can break out of this kind of 6-monthly cycle where all eyes are on the budget and all eyes are on the public finances.
Yeah.
And look, there's been quite a lot of changes in Treasury as well and moving about. And, you know, Darren Jones has gone over to number 10. Who are the people that maybe the public aren't so aware of, but what are the roles or people that are quite influential to the Chancellor within Treasury?
So there is a team that effectively does a lot of the business engagement with external organisations like ourselves. They are quite central to feeding up the asks and the requests and what others would like to see within the economy. They are quite influential within the Treasury. That's sort of the business engagement team and the broader team that sit around that in the enterprise and growth unit. There is also a team that does the sort of strategy planning and budget that bring together internally what the budget looks like, and again more of an internal facing function, but quite influential. I think if I can, I'd go a little bit back to when we're talking about the OBR. It's quite topical. There is also an inquiry that the House of Lords are doing around fiscal frameworks and the role of the OBR, because there's been a bit of talk about potentially moving to sort of one fiscal event a year. We're hoping to submit some evidence to that to make our suggestions on what businesses would like to see. But there really is this issue around the role of the OBR and these forecasts are just, you know, they were set up during the coalition government to effectively provide the Treasury with a bit more independence. It's morphed into something far more than I think anyone had thought at the time. And so I think there is good to have that conversation around what that looks like. And we're interested in feeding into that because I think, like I said, about policy uncertainty and volatility, members care a lot about that. But I think going back to your original question, there are teams within the Treasury that play some of that central coordination. But a lot of that also hinges on what others are sharing with the Treasury, including ourselves. And it's quite telling when you talk about who else is influencing decisions. There have been joint letters from think tanks across the political spectrum on the left and right, all in agreement around what we should do on tax, which, at least in my lifetime, I don't think I've ever seen. I mean, Louise can correct me, she's got more experience than this.
Sounds like you're making out that she's much older than
you. No. She's
very youthful.
She will correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I have never seen anything like it. And I think it's quite telling that it's not just us saying some of these things around what should be on the table and what government should do. Think tanks from the left and the right all came together to sign a joint letter to say, here are the sort of 7 or 8 areas, or maybe 9 areas, that government should focus on reforming to make good on their promise around focusing on the growth mission. And so those, like, think tanks as well as business groups and others have that influence as well. But a lot of it is external, and this, some of the teams in Treasury would be the ones funneling some of that up to the Chancellor and her team.
And just to kind of build on that, I mean, I think some of the arguments that were in that kind of joint letter were really the things that we were talking about, or Rain talked about in her op-ed kind of back in September for The Guardian, if people saw that. So that is really about, one, like I said, making sure that growth is really the lens through which all these decisions are made, but where you really need to show what is that strategy, what is the story behind the decisions that are made, particularly around taxes. Actually, how can you make decisions that, yes, maybe raise some of the revenue that the Chancellor needs to, but where you're looking at improving the system, where can you simplify it, where can you make sure we have got better incentives for investment rather than some of the kind of cliff edges and complexities that are there as well. And I think also, just going back to your question about who are some of the decision makers around the Chancellor, like you said, we've seen some of those changes with number 10 and Darren Jones going over. One of the other pivotal people within this as well is kind of Torsten Rebell. So he has obviously previously been at the Resolution Foundation, is now the MP for, I think it's Swansea. But he's been given a role in particular to help the Chancellor really be her kind of right-hand man around, you know, what is this better kind of economic strategy? And, you know, we've got a really good relationship with him. Rain and I went to see him last week. And I think, you know, he is really one of the kind of key decision makers within this as well.
Jordan, you keeping your eye out on anyone or anything?
Well, I mean, I think the challenge of this budget more than most is that because working people's taxes has been such a big focus of the external narrative, it will bring in constituents that most of us won't see. So the Parliamentary Labour Party and the parliamentary committees and the influence that your MPs will have over Number 10 and over the Chancellor directly as an MP herself. And so I think what we can't see, or what we can't rate, I guess, in terms of influence is the pressure that will politically be the Chancellor will politically be under from her MPs, who will be listening to the doorsteps every day of people saying, well, is my income tax going to go up? And so I think there are things that we have a good handle on at the CBI, like the Torsten relationships and those types of things, where we talk about economic policy. But on the other side of the ledger, it's very difficult for businesses to understand the pressure that the Chancellor will be under as a member of Parliament. And those parliamentary committees happen every week with a series of very influential MPs, and they will be telling her, you've got to be careful on working people's taxes. And so that's the bit that we won't see.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And I think we'd like to think within the building that we've got quite a strong kind of political radar. But like you say, we're not walking the street, doorstop. But I think one of the issues sometimes here is with this budget, people have talked quite a lot about there's a trade-off between the economics and the politics. And I can see very much what they mean by that in terms of those decisions that she makes on the day. But actually, I think that is a bit of a false choice when you're thinking long term. So making those kind of good, sound economic decisions now, which increase growth, which help to increase investment, they are ultimately what will mean that businesses can pay higher wages to people, can increase living standards throughout the economy. And if you're thinking about, again, the issues which I'm sure will define the next election, that again will be, to Mo's point, do people feel better off now than they did a few years ago? I think the challenge is some of these things take a long time to come to fruition, but that means that, you know, it's even more important in many ways to be making those decisions now and early on in a parliament. But it will feel like there's a big trade-off on the day, but she has to be thinking about, okay, well, what will this mean for next year, for the next 5 years, even for the next 10 years, to put the UK on a kind of better track.
I do wonder if, you know, the sort of just realizing how hard this is. You know, it all sounds so simple, so obvious, but when you're actually in the job and you suddenly realize, like, this is a juggernaut that really takes a long time to shift it. I was going to just touch on, as I sort of mentioned earlier, you know, it's a bit of a negotiation even within the CBI. You know, policy have their pillars, the things they're passionate about. The regions and nations have the things that they're wanting to focus on. So it'd be sort of interesting just to go, you know, what were maybe some of the things we were considering, or maybe we still really care about? Just because it's not in the submission doesn't mean that we're not maybe talking about it, championing about it. So it'd be good to maybe just touch on some of those things as well. Like, Mo, why don't you start us off with what was on the table, could have been on the table, or still out there to be dealt with?
It's a good question. There is a lot. So we have to be quite disciplined in what we include in the submission. And despite, as I think we are very disciplined, given that we are a cross-economy representative body, our submission is still probably the longest of any I've read. It's just over 40 pages. And within that, there's a lot of good evidence for the asks that we have and the backing and the evidence that we have for those asks. To give you an example, we have said in our submission and in our letter to the Chancellor, we do not want to see any further tax rises on business. Now, I think underneath that, and we've done a lot of this sort of privately over the last 12 months, but even in our submission last year, like a good example is we said windfall taxes and sector-specific taxes are really damaging to not just the sector that it affects, but to any sector that sees that happening somewhere else, because they'll think, if we do well, if we invest, if we grow, the government will then tax us in the same way that, for example, we've seen with the energy profits levy, or the more recent rumours around banking taxes, which have been a bit more quashed in the last couple of days, and I think rightfully so. And I think, you know, while we don't talk about those in a submission, for example, it's not to say we don't communicate some of that privately, and we try and share a lot of that because members share that, the impact of that and the impact it has on confidence. So it's that sort of thing where we have to take a call around what we'll have cut through and what we'll have that, you know, that aligns to our headline messaging. But there is a lot that then we will share with government through other channels, because the budget and a fiscal event is not the only way that we communicate. Another example is around sort of cuts in regulation. You know, the government's made this commitment to cut regulatory burden by 25%. that will have a different process, as will how we work on the industrial strategy, which Jordan can talk to much better than I can. So there are different ways of doing some of that, but we have to be quite choiceful, I guess, in what we include and what had the measures that we've included had the broadest support across the CBI's membership base. And that's how we're led to put together the measures that we have. And I think that broadly, they, you know, it's a balance between that and what would have the most impact. And I think we've got the balance quite right on that. And again, comes back to that point I was making about how much agreement there is. There is a lot of agreement on the measures that we've called for. And I've seen a lot of other people adopting some of those and echoing them, which says to me we're on the right track with some of those. And hopefully we get to see them come November 26th.
Perfect. I'm conscious of time, so I might move us on to where we think this is all going to end up. Do you think tax is going to go up, and or is it going to be something more subtle?
So I think it's almost inevitable that we're going to see taxes increase. I think that, I mean, quite literally billion-dollar questions is where exactly yeah. those are going to fall. There has been a little bit of a discussion about what the mix might be of kind of tax increases versus perhaps spending cuts. I think the majority will be on that tax side. You might see a kind of 80-20 type thing, but I think they will probably do less on the spending side, particularly because we've just gone through the spending review. But I would encourage them to think about particularly where they can have more productivity across the public sector, where they can think about, again, using tech and AI. And I think, I don't know whether they will make any announcements this budget, but definitely I think they have committed. They will come back around this question about welfare. And I think that is something that needs to be addressed as well. In terms of where that kind of apps might fall on taxes, I think, again, it seems likely that they will look at income tax and they will think about those manifesto commitments. In terms of that long list, I expect that that is on there and they have given that as an option to the OBR. Whether it makes the cut on the day, I think again it comes down to that kind of political gumption and are they prepared to take some of that short-term pain for what will mean that the public finances take a more sustainable footing later on. And I think the reason why income tax is mentioned so much is because I think nobody obviously wants to see higher taxes, but that is the less distortive way to do it. And our big message on business taxes is that can have a really distortive impact. It will mean that firms, unfortunately, will have to perhaps cut back on investment, cut back on hiring. Those are exactly the kind of decisions that we've seen businesses being forced to take because of things like the NICS increase. So I'm not expecting, but we are, you know, continuing to make that point in all of our discussions. I'm not expecting we will see broad-based tax increases for businesses like we saw at the last budget. I think, you know, the government and the Chancellor understands the kind of pain and the impact that caused. But, you know, there is the possibility that they're still looking at things around the edges. And again, that's where, you know, any of these discussions that we're having with them, you know, we're really making sure we can feed in those insights directly about the impacts and the trade-offs they might have to make. I think one of the things that we know that they are going to make a decision though on this budget is on business rates. That has been a big priority with the CBI for a long time. The particular issue that they're thinking about for this time round is they say that they're going to provide some more permanent relief to the retail, hospitality and leisure sector. But I think one of the challenges that we've been talking to them about is they're effectively talking about it in a kind of Rob Peter to pay Paul way. So they might provide some benefit to retail, hospitality and leisure, but it might be at the cost of kind of warehousing and other sectors across the economy. So the bigger challenge that we've been talking to them about is more longer term reform. Again, I don't think we're going to have an announcement of policies on that in this budget, but I think they might signal, you know, what is that roadmap? What is the next step to get to that longer term solution? So I think if they are able to do that, that's positive. But businesses might have to still wait and see on that one, I think.
And that's something that we're always, I suppose, what we're trying to do as well is trying to work through very quickly what are the unintended consequences of policy. I think we saw that with NICS last year. I don't think they really realised the impact it would have on particularly those large retail businesses who employ a lot of low-wage workers out of that. And the impact on hiring decisions and all that that's follow right. through.
And that's where, you know, we see a lot of the value in the work we do and the conversations that we have of really helping government to understand, you know, what is that perception, or is that impact on decisions in the boardroom, and that kind of real world impact, as it were? Because, you know, as experienced as some of the ministers and cabinet colleagues might be, actually, if you look across the table, there's not many of them that have got that kind of boardroom expertise, that background in businesses. So it is really explained to them the impact of some of these decisions and, like, say, unintended consequences they might have.
And more, another one that's been trialled is around pension contributions, which, even though I'm no pension expert, I think could also have an impact on NICs as well.
Yeah.
Possibly. You know, how credible is all this? And I suppose what you'll be thinking about, and will be glued to the TV set on the 26th, is what will it mean in the shorter and longer term for business? Do you want to just sort of expand on that?
Sure. So, yeah, good point on the rumour around national insurance contributions on for pensions, specifically on salary sacrifice. That's been something that's been in the news the last few days. And again, this comes back to my earlier point about it will have been a set of asks that the Treasury submitted to the OBR, and some of those come out. And it's on the table. So we know it's on the table. But I also think this is where the CBI comes into its own, because we're able to then immediately, even though it's a rumour and we don't know if it'll happen or not, where members will share some of those insights with us of, if they do this, we'll have to do that. And for this specific rumour, for example, we know from the members that have reached out to us that about 75% would not be able to increase their pensions contributions. So effectively, it would be a tax on employees, which would mean they save less, and it's detrimental in the short term because there's less going into their pension pot. But actually, when you think about compounding over 30, 40 years, it could be huge for businesses, for employees in the long term, when we already know that something like 4 in 10 are not saving enough for the lifestyle that they want when it comes to retirement. And that's the sort of thing that I think we are very quick in compiling some of that and sharing it with the Treasury and with, in this case, the Department for Work and Pensions. And that's where we can highlight some of those unintended consequences almost immediately if they are thinking about this. And if they're not, it just allows us to share some of those insights with government anyway. But it goes to back to that point that Louise mentioned, that if people in, you know, it's good for us to be able to share some of those insights and discussions that are had at the boardroom level, because they are often very private and not seen. And if businesses feel comfortable in sharing that, it is our duty to then share that with government so they understand the impact. And I think that's where, if we're being honest, we had some of the challenges last year where the national insurance change caught many people, if not everyone, unaware, especially the change in the threshold rather than the rate change. And that's why it's had such a big impact, and members continue to raise that as an issue 12 months later. So I think that's the pensions one's a great example, and one where we'll be feeding some of that insight back to government.
Yeah, and I think to come in on that, I think it's probably quite stress enough of how, if they make that decision, I think it is symptomatic of having this focus on the short term at the real detriment of the long term. Like, it doesn't make any sense to kind of do this given the impact that it could have. And actually, one of the big things it does is really run counter, which you often find in some of these, like, really bad decisions, runs completely counter to another objective of government, which is to increase the adequacy of pension savings across the economy. And they've literally just launched a pension commission to do this and to look into this. And it's something that we are working with the pension commission for, and they've asked us to put together a panel of businesses to feed into that. And this kind of puts the cart before the horse of any of those discussions, and, like I say, really runs counter to what they do. So I think if they were to make this, and obviously, like you say, at the moment it's only a rumour, but if they were to make that decision, I think that would be really, really damaging to both the UK, but really in that confidence that the government make the right decisions and make the right call when they are thinking about growth, when they are thinking about investment across the economy.
I think that's probably one of the biggest frustrations we get from our members, is when the different departments aren't joined up. And one of the big promises, of course, with this government was that sort of mission-based, cross-department working together. And therefore, when you see that sort of bashing off against each other, is very frustrating. I obviously have to pitch that it's obviously a very good reason why you should be a member of the CBI, because you can bring your real, genuine concerns or issues directly to us. And we are speaking all year, every month to these departments. But Jordan, from a competitive point of view, because that's also really important, is the decisions the Chancellor makes, what Number 10 makes of how does it present the UK to that wider economy? Does it make us an attractive destination, or can we keep companies that are here? So what are the sort of things you would like to see protected? We've obviously got things that we're asking, but there's things in place already that we wouldn't want meddled with or moved around.
Yes, there's many ways in which we already deploy finance across the economy, which are very, very good. The regulatory wraparound, sandboxes in financial services, the easements, I guess, that the Chancellor has been pushing across economic regulation, like Mo mentioned earlier. A lot of that train that's now on the track should just carry on, and we shouldn't meddle with it, because getting regulators to move does take time, and getting firms to respond to their regulatory movements also takes time. And so on the regulatory side, I think this government has started probably broadly in the right place. For us, look, we'd love to see the Employment Rights Bill more part of that regulatory discussion, but that's a bigger topic, perhaps for another day. And then one of our other asks is around putting kind of incorporating CapEx into R&D spend. But the UK actually has a very good R&D base already, within which there are multiple reliefs for lots of kind of growing and scaling firms, a part of the economy where, frankly, we just need to wrap our hands around them a bit tighter, because they need a bit more help. And so there's a whole load of reliefs that already exist in the system around research and development. And also the government has lent in quite heavily post-COVID on making those research partnerships work. They have a big body of work that's driven by the Regulatory Innovation Office on how you kind of break down barriers for firms to scale faster. And so on the R&D and tech side, I think there's a lot of good stories actually we want to hang on to. And on the regulatory side, I think there's a good amount of intention too. And some of these things aren't naturally supposed to be buffeted by budgets and spring statements and those types of things. And so they're two examples, I think, of things that just need to stay on the track. The other big one, I guess, is the industrial strategy, which people just seem to have waited forever for. And now that it's here, there are kind of committees to make it work. There are some spending commitments. There are regional investment summits. There are sector deals. There's a whole load of things that the government can point at to say, this is how this is going to work for you. But again, these things will just take a whole parliamentary term to kick in. And so don't allow your fiscal events to kind of infect that work, because lots of other people are doing lots of work on it already across government. And that's another thing that just needs to stay on the track. Maybe go a bit faster too while it's on that track, but it just needs to stay on the track and not be pushed off.
And do you think then that there is too much stored just in the budget? Like, how much can it really solve? It's just one thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's lots of things that it can't solve, and I guess we're going to find that out on the 26th. Yeah. But I think because of the cycle, like we were talking about, that we get stuck in a world where there is more headroom, line departments have more power. They can do more spending decisions themselves. Not everything has to be bidded up to a central pot. And so if we're trying to get to a world in which more people can make more effective policy decisions with business engagement through line departments that don't have to wait for a fiscal event every time, that's also surely a good thing. It's a good thing for ministers, for sure, because then they don't have to wait for the budget too to get anything done. And so I do think there is a breaking out of the cyclical trap thing that is really, really important to businesses, but also important to their government stakeholders, because they don't want to be in the trap either. And so if you take the Employment Rights Bill, that's legislative. You know, there's got to be parliamentary process around it. And that's why we are that's where we're engaging so widely beyond the kind of Treasury type discussions on how you make that work. And so it's not all about the budget, but the budget does a lot of stuff.
So on that, I think it's probably quite a good point for us to finish up. Thank you for all of your contributions today. Very insightful as always. I think what I'm hearing is our message to government is probably stay focused on the growth mission, make it easy to invest and deliver what's already been promised. And we'd probably be quite happy with that. And of course, no tax rises for business being the big one. We're going to be back after the budget. Mo's team runs a survey with all our members. So once we've got that pulled in together, we will be able to talk to you about what it really means for business and the wider economy. But thank you for listening today. Do remember to subscribe. And if you want to see Mo's budget submission, you can download it from cbi.org.uk. Thank you.